Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 85. This Friday in Minneapolis, stand-up comedy with me, Chris Hardwick, at the Varsity Theater. It's about as radio voicey as I get. Do come to that show, though, if you are in Minneapolis. Also, a ton of other shows coming up if you go to Nerdist.com. You can see the upcoming stand-up schedule. Shows in Detroit, Seattle, Brooklyn, Dallas, Meltdown here in L.A., also, the book The Nerdist Way is available for pre-order right now on Amazon.com. That is also on the website Nerdist.com, which I own. Uncomfortably long hugs go to our sponsor for this episode, Hover.com. Hover is all about making domain registration simple. So a lot of domain registration sites are shells to sell you other services. That is not the case with Hover. They just want to register your domain and help you manage it. They have a no-hold policy for customer service calls Monday through Friday from 9 to 8 p.m. When you call, you get a live person. They will not put you on hold. You can set up email addresses, forward email addresses, redirect domains to other website addresses, create URL extensions, set privacy controls. They will also give you Whois privacy for free. So go to hover.com, HOVER/Nerdist, and get 10% off using the offer code Nerdist. Thank you so much to Hover for their support. And now the Nerdist Podcast number 85 with Damon Lindelof. Ooh, it's a good one.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
And we are recording.
All right.
We did it.
We did it. We're coming to you not live from the...
live to tape, just like the Cosby Show.
Live to tape. Yeah, so get out your old reel-to-reels.
Yeah, that's what everyone knew the Cosby Show for, being live to tape.
I always remember that's that. That's right. It was recorded for a live studio audience.
Boy, every time that
the
Rudy
only thing
would,
I think of
every time that Rudy would come down the stairs lip-syncing a song that she was too young to have known. Comedy gold.
There were 3 Rudys, I believe.
What? No.
Yeah, she was triplets. Keisha Knight Pulliam and then her sister Victoria.
No,
Knight,
really?
No, of course not. I'm just...
Oh, God. You just almost
you
melted
just
my mind.
My childhood.
Damon Lindelof, our guest today on the Nerdist Podcast.
It was around the same time as like Milo and Otis. If one of them died, they just throw the other one in.
We need another Otis.
Yeah. It's one of those viable rumors, though, that you actually... Because you know there were several Olsen twins. You basically go, there could have been 3 Rudys.
I think the other one was Victoria Knight Pulliam. Like, they were all just Knight Pulliam.
I remember when Full House, when there was like, you know, you find out that like, I never understood why it said Mary Kate Ashley Olsen. I was like, that's a really long, weird name.
Right.
And then you find out that they're twins. And then I remember when Uncle Jesse and Rebecca had twins. I thought that was the most weird meta.
So then did they have to get quadruplets to swap them out?
Yeah, exactly.
I think they got triplets or something.
No, they had for those
quadruplets.
Kids?
Yeah, all fucking babies look the same.
The fact that you're referring to them by their character names is a little
Uncle Jesse, just, Rebecca.
You want to say John Stamos?
John Stamos.
Well, actually, John Stamos was played by himself
Lori
and
Loughlin.
Ephraim Stamos, his brother.
Yeah.
at the same time.
Also true.
Swapped them out.
And Lori Loughlin from the movie Rad.
Oh, Lori
Loughlin.
What about
the later episodes when Mary-Kate and Ashley would play this, like, opposite personalities of, you know.
You got it, dude.
Anyway,
you got it, dude.
Like,
yeah. Superman, yeah. Different Superman. Sure.
Like dream sequence.
I hear they're rebooting Full House. Another reboot. That's not true. Lori Loughlin, you know, she was married to Massimo, the guy who started Massimo Clothing.
Oh, really?
Yep.
The other Stussy? Massimo?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think they're together anymore. But we're not here to gossip about Lori Loughlin.
Are we?
Really?
What am I doing here?
Guys, save it for the Loughlin cast.
Yes,
the Loughlin,
exactly. Yeah, right.
Our other podcast, Loughcast.
Yeah, Loughcast.
From Loughlin, Nevada.
Damon Lindelof, you're the best, man. We did a panel with you at Meltdown Comics. Oh, probably like 3 years ago now, or 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was two. I think about 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was before Web Soup ever started up, and it was season 4 of Lost.
Somewhere like in the cracks between seasons 4 and 5.
I remember it was on at the time because like the actual like panel was during like when the episode was on TV.
That's right. Yes.
And it was when our friends who did Comics on Comics, right?
Yeah.
And then Doug Benson was there as well.
Yeah. I think it was right after the strike. That's my memory of
that
it.
That sounds about right.
Man. That seems right. Yeah, but it was really fun and we talked a lot about Walking Dead.
Yeah, and Jeff Katz got real sweaty.
Jeff Katz got all sweaty because people were asking him Wolverine questions.
Someone's like, "Hey, I was wondering." He's like, "Before anyone says it," and then he just like berates the crowd for not being angry yet at him. I remember that.
He wanted to make it very clear that it was that Wolverine was not his fault. That even though he was the studio person, that the studio like they did a bunch of stuff without his consent or whatever.
Yeah.
And so Wolverine did not turn out the way he wanted.
I didn't mind it. I'll see any X-Men movie. I
still haven't seen it.
I'm really looking forward to the new one.
Fucking trailer is astounding.
It looks fucking fantastic. And you know, this is the year where I really feel like I feel like this is sort of a pivotal year for comic book movies because we've sort of become saturated with, you know, like everything being made. And so it could be the year like if Thor is not amazing and Green Lantern's not amazing, then people are going to start saying like, "Oh, comic book movies."
Yeah, and you know, and as much as I want to see those Marvel movies, there's a very kind of boy bandish being formed, kind of in sync. It's like, you know, it's like that idea of like we are making the Avengers. You will love Thor.
Right.
You know, like it's like the Avengers. You know, the movie that I wanted to see is like, you know, let's just do an origin story like for all four of those guys in one single movie. Like just do Captain America in like 20 minutes and do Thor in 20 minutes and do Hawkeye in 20 minutes and then, you know, and then do they're all together. But it's like, you know, maybe Thor's rad and the trailer looks rad and Captain America, all that stuff looks great. But there is this kind of feeling.
How are they going to squeeze all of our money out of us?
Yeah, that's right.
I can't get around Thor's dye job. I can't get around the dye goatee job. Like that's
natural.
No, really?
Brown. Yeah.
Looks kind of orange. No, not brown. It just looks kind of orangish to me.
So let me get this clear. You're buying the giant hammer.
Yep.
You're with Asgard.
I suspend my disbelief in weird places.
It's the goatee dye job. Yeah. All right.
The same way that when I
wasn't that the dude that played Kirk's father in Star Trek?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris Hemsworth.
The same way that when people complain about a character that I voice on a Nickelodeon show as being a male cow with udders, I'm like, you know, animals don't talk either, right? They get really upset.
They don't.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Oh my god.
They're all played by Victoria Knight Pulliam.
Callback. Do you guys have sound effects? Is there a callback bell that you're going to put in later?
A callback bell.
Yeah.
Bing, bing, bing.
You guys definitely need a callback bell in here.
Well, when we actually get a production budget, we'll hire an assistant, and then we'll just have him put in things like callback.
Well, you know, usually though,
can't be a bell. It has to be like that's a callback.
Yeah. Usually though, when there is a callback, there is like someone going, "Got a nice callback." So that could easily be it.
That could totally.
Can you do
guy.
That for the remainder of at least this podcast?
Sure, I'll try to remember. Give me a point if I don't do it right away.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a callback.
This is the signal.
You know, I haven't talked to you since this happened, but I had so much fun at that Lost show that we did at the UCB, the last, like, the farewell show.
That was a blast.
Yeah.
I have a recording of it, and I had always intended to put it out as a podcast, but I've been so busy that I've not been able to edit it down. It's super. I mean, the show was like 3 hours long.
Epic.
And there were a lot of things that were just too visual to put in an audio podcast. So,
correct.
So I never cut it down. But so much fun.
But Titus Welliver doing Al Pacino alone.
Must be
her. It went on so long that it was like, wow, this has gotten really bad, and then it got good again. That's how long it went. When you're just basically, it's the Lawrence of Arabia experience where you dial out and back in again.
And you and Carlton just sat there through the whole show, and it was
and took it.
And took it.
Took it. Prison rules.
Prison rules. But I feel like that live show was. Well, there wasn't any bashing, was it? It was a celebration of the show.
My sketch made fun of the bad beard that Jack wore. That was like the one thing.
Which is, you know, that's bashing is all in the eye of the beholder.
And, right.
You know, I'm learning this on a day by day.
God damn it!
I got into a lot of trouble for flaming the Fine Brothers on Twitter after I saw the show.
Oh, that's right.
Because I felt like their video piece at the end of that UCB thing was not in the spirit of the roast, you know?
Nope.
Which is, first off, it wasn't called a roast.
No, right. It was a celebration of love. That's what I thought it was. Like, when Cody and I came with the bit, we're just
if you invite me to a roast and Don Rickles makes fun of how small my dick is, then I got what I paid for.
Right.
But this was, you know, and those guys, you know, are very hit and miss in terms of, you know, their comedy, and when they're funny, they're incredibly funny, and when they're not funny, it doesn't work. But I felt like that, especially kind of in the spirit of the finales next week, they're calling us out on the fact that we weren't going to answer enough questions satisfactorily, mm-hmm. when they knew that was kind of the bugaboo. It was sort of, that was the uncomfortable moment of the evening for me.
I remember being quiet. And then, like, I was like, what's going on?
I didn't see it because the room was so crowded.
Wow, to play that video, I was in the booth for that show.
And that was, like, the closer. So it was kind of like, but, you know, the mistake that I made was basically stripping them of their fandom, which, mm-hmm. you know, you're not in a position to do. It's like, I totally regret that. If they consider themselves to be fans of the show, then they're fans of the show, and that's all there is to it. But, you know, I was being, you know, pissy, whiny little baby about it, and, you know, have come to see things from a different perspective now.
But here's what I understand, because, you know, I get people that complain to me. For the most part, everyone's very cool to me about this show and Web Soup and whatever, and I do get, but I do get a small percentage of complainers, and what I think people don't understand is, you know, yeah, to them, they're just voicing one complaint or one concern. But what you realize is, the more successful something becomes, then that number just goes up. And then every day you start to feel like, because you spend more time focusing on the complaints to try to put out fires for people. And then you're just like, what the fuck? Please, just give me a little break.
Well, it's like if people are watching something, there's like, you know, a certain small number of people watching it. There's going to be a certain number of people that like it and don't like it. But then when more people see it, more people will like it. But then the number of people that don't like it will grow even more.
And what you kind of have to remember is, like, the more that number goes up, the more that means what you're putting out into the world is reaching people.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and the reality of being a fanboy, which I am and was born and raised, is the idea that fundamentally some pieces of material you will have an adversarial relationship with, and that's the way that you define it. So, you know, if you're a Boston Red Sox fan, for example, you can choose to, you know, to categorically love the Boston Red Sox, or you can choose to just hate the Boston Red Sox, but you are still a huge fan, but all you talk about is how much they suck. And
well, like
in any sports team
right now, it's very difficult to not say that, because they are 2-9.
Right,
that's 2 wins and 9 losses anyway.
And the fundamental, you know, if you're sucking, you know, the fans have a right to basically say, I'm a fan of this thing and I love this thing and it's starting to suck and I want you to know it. So you know,
now, Dan, when you say you were a fanboy growing up, what was it that, like, you were really fanatical about when you were a kid?
You know, Star Wars was, I think, the sort of defining, you know, kind of moment of my childhood. And then, of course, that, you know, that was sort of a gateway drug into, you know, indie and Trek and all those, you know, and all those other things.
Yeah.
Were you a big video gamer, comic book guy growing up?
You know, a video gamer when I was growing up was owning an Atari 2600 or a ColecoVision, or
so you love pitfall, right?
Or for those of us who were lucky enough to own an Intellivision, which had a gun.
Yes,
yes, that's the level of and then all through college, I think, you know, kind of a Nintendo 64 was the cutting edge gaming device when I was
in
college.
So you got GoldenEye and you played that all through college.
Absolutely.
That was everyone's summer. That summer that came out, that's right. Everybody.
Oh, man, for me, it was getting the Nintendo, just the regular Nintendo system and playing Super Mario Brothers 3 over and over again where you could put on the Tanuki suit. That fucking Tanuki suit floored my world. I love that so much. And the 26...
And you're wearing it right now.
Yes! Oh, why is this audio only?
How do you sit down with that tail? Yeah. Super Mario Brothers 3 first appeared in The Wizard. I remember like how mind-blowing that was.
Oh, that's right. That was the big thing for Fred Savage at the end.
Yeah. He gets to play... Or
and
Fred
he found
Savage,
the whistle.
The whistle. Right. Yeah.
Wait, like, Fred Savage is not in The Wizard? Table. Isn't he?
No, he is in The Wizard, but it's his little brother.
Oh, yes, right. It's his little savantish. Yes, of course.
He's an autistic brother that just wants the divorce to go
Kevin Bacon's
away.
In that movie. Christian Slater. Christian Slater's in The Wizard.
And Beau Bridges.
Did you know there are 5 Fred Savages?
Yeah, they keep on getting killed off.
Victoria
was
Knight Savage.
sorry.
You missed your call.
That's a callback.
Yeah, there you go.
In my head, I was thinking, I was like saying, and also fucking girl from Rilo Kiley is in The Wizard.
Jenny Lewis. Yep.
Wow.
Jenny Lewis.
Yeah,
of Jenny and Johnny.
Yes.
I am out of my league in this room.
Okay. No.
Just a band.
But on the iPad, Atari just released their full library of emulators. So for all of their arcade games and then for all the 2600 games. And so I bought it. It's $15 for all of it. And it's funny because you think back, you're like, of course, the 2600. You could shoot lines at squares. And you think very fondly about it. But then you start playing a couple of the games and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah.
Right.
And you it, like, I didn't.
You're like, did I really spend hours playing E.T.? To make my neck go up and to make the plant grow?
Like, Adventure. I played Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
And... I mean, I had playing Superman Adventure and Pitfall. I had a sore and a callus from the Atari game controller, and then just playing
the
it for 2
right.
minutes. Yeah, with
that callus,
and then of course I get it on the iPad. I'm like, oh yeah, oh okay, next one. Oh yeah, Missile Command. Oh yeah, okay, next one.
I can still play Missile Command. I still get into that one.
You still
it's much better on the console with the ball, though.
Yeah, but if you didn't have them at your fingertips, though, you wouldn't be sliding through them like that.
I
gotta get to the next one.
I love that move in Missile Command when you get super high up on the levels and you would just whip the ball and then just start hitting the button. So you just had like the stream.
I don't know if you know this, but Billy Mitchell stole Roy Schiltz's Missile Command score. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
What?
With that.
Roy Schiltz, Captain Awesome.
Captain Awesome, riding the Awesomeobile to fame and fortune.
The King of Kong references the guy's making.
Is there anything Billy Mitchell
doesn't
not sully? It's like
hot sauce. I've tried that hot sauce. It is great.
Well,
it's really good.
Really?
I went to.
He is the most well-rounded.
Yeah, it was really good.
Wow. Man of the hot sauce.
He's a winner. He'll make good hot sauce.
You know, you can't even use the word winner anymore because fucking Charlie Sheen ruined that too. God damn it. What is wrong with people? You know, if you go to the Charlie Sheen show, you deserve to lose the money that you're throwing at it. I can't believe people would show up and pay $100 a ticket and then walk out halfway through. Like, what? Oh, so the guy who's never done stand-up and who is the crackhead who's never been on stage before?
The fantasy baseball team I'm playing this week is called the New York Sheens.
That guy on the
other end of that computer.
But in defense of buying a ticket, not that I have, there's the tightrope effect, which when you go to the circus, you do not want to see them make it across the tightrope. You actually want to see them fall. So the idea that Charlie Sheen might die, might hit someone from the audience, might ingest illegal drugs on, all these things could happen at the show. Mm-hmm. And you could say, I was there when Charlie Sheen died on stage.
Literally.
Yes.
Yeah. His heart
exploded. That's why you buy a ticket.
They'll call him the 3,000. All the people that witnessed Charlie Sheen's death went on.
I want to go see Book of Mormon, but nobody's going to die. Probably.
I so want to see Book of Mormon.
Yeah,
I
so
awesome.
Want to see it.
I want to
see
it so bad.
That guy's heart is probably encased in a crack shell, and his heart's just gonna burst through it, like in Superman when he builds the Fortress of Solitude and then just comes bursting through the crystals. That's gonna happen to his heart.
I just hate it because it's taking attention away from the more talented of the two brothers, which is
Emilio Estevez. Yes. Yeah.
That's fucking Repo Man.
Nice
right
pronunciation there.
Emilio Estevez.
Yes.
Emilio Estevez. E. Charlie Sheen.
You mean Gordon Bombay from the Mighty Ducks?
Yeah, I meant
That's
Gordon Bombay from the Mighty Ducks.
I mean Otto from Repo Man.
Otto from Repo Man.
Was Estevez in Mighty Ducks 2?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And 3?
Yeah. Yeah, he went for that paycheck.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good Which for him.
Probably
Good
an awesome, him. Awesome paycheck.
He didn't pull a math out when it's basically like, no, I'm not fucking do bad. I'm not going to Bad News Bears, do Japan. You can fucking, you can get the guy from Knott's Landing. call William
Devane.
Get the
guy from Knott's Landing. I'm not doing
it. Yeah, it was William Devane. It's like, you know.
Oh, William Devane.
Yeah, it's like, they kind of like refer to Buttermaker in that movie, but. He's not around.
It's like in Jaws 2 when they refer to Richard Dreyfuss's character. Matt Hooper's off at in Australia looking at sharks. That's why he's not in this one.
He moved to the lake in Piranha 3D.
Boy, that amazing the remake that they did. I did not see the remake of the Bad News Bears, but it's just so funny to me. The original Bad News Bears, where they just had, like, for a studio movie to have kids drinking and swearing and using
and
the N-word.
Smoking.
That's why the remake wasn't. It was just it lost all that. You realize that was kind of the fun to watch these kids just be kind of raw.
And the sexy kid in Bad News Bears was Tiny Rorschach.
That's the best. That Kelly Leak.
Yeah.
Yep. He was.
And now Krueger.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched that Nightmare on Elm Street. I really wanted to love it. Because I think he's so awesome.
Yeah.
And Jack Earl Haley. And it just you need a certain amount of cheek to play Freddy Krueger, and he played him as a very serious character.
Oh, as a child molester?
Well, even the movie whole, yeah.
You need to be a fun child molester.
Yeah.
Right.
The movie, on a whole, like, it's like the first death was the best one. There was no death that compared to the first death of the movie.
Because let's talk about this for a second. If you're a child molester, there does have to be a degree of cheek to you.
Yeah,
if you're
going
to
have a certain amount of humor.
You have some charm. Yeah.
I've got puppies in my van.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's ridiculous that I have to go buy all these puppies to lure these kids into the van.
Sure.
Yeah.
So there is a certain.
Ted Bundy was charming. You know,
hilariously charming.
Yeah.
All right, I better put the fake cast on now. I need to change my tire. Let's just go through the motions. It's going to be weird.
And John Wayne Gacy was charming as well.
As a clown.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Negating his charm.
Did you see Gacy? The movie Gacy?
I did not think we'd end up here.
With Francis?
With Francis. Yeah,
the guy who played Francis from Pee Wee's Big Adventure played Gacy.
I haven't seen that.
There was a stream of movies made by the same studio that they did. They did Bundy, they did Gacy, and they did one other. I can't really remember what it was.
Janet and I watched Gacy with Paul F. Tompkins and his wife Janie, and I think we picked it up at the video store because I think the review on the front of the box just said, "Looks great." And so,
can't argue with that.
This takes place in Illinois. Palm trees in the background. I mean, it was just loaded
with that.
Oh yeah, just loaded with that kind of stuff.
I will now watch that.
What are you currently kind of nerding out over, Damon Lindelof?
Wow.
You're pretty busy working. Do you have time to consume anything?
Yeah, there's my life now compared to what it was when we were doing the show is is radically different. So, you know, we were working 70 to 80 hour weeks on Lost, so there was no opportunity to watch television or read books or
anything. Three assholes to do a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just basically like, let's go all day.
Well, I remember when we did that panel, like when they asked what you were watching, you just said, I just watch a couple reality shows because I don't want to think about it.
That's
anything.
Right.
You get off of work and you're just like, I just don't want to see a crazy story. I don't want to see a clever turn.
So when I finished, I was basically like, I downloaded all of Breaking Bad, all of Battlestar Galactica, and all of The Wire. And I meticulously, we finished in May. That's been, you know, the last year of my life has been watching those series in their entirety. And obviously Breaking Bad is only through three seasons. And
was
it's still
The Wire as good as everybody says?
The Wire is the greatest television show ever made.
All right.
Without qualification, ever made. And considering it has no robots, it has no time travel, there's no zombies.
There's wires.
Yeah, there are. There are wires.
I bought The Wire. I haven't. That is one of the next ones on my list as well. Because everyone, I just hope that I don't get too. How many seasons were there of The Wire?
There were five seasons.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and each one its own sort of little kind of fiefdom.
Don't think Breaking Bad's going to take that? Because I feel Breaking Bad is taking that title. For a lot of people,
Breaking Bad could potentially be the greatest television series ever, but it's only three seasons in.
Do you think you have to wait till a series is done to kind of
declare it the greatest television show ever?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
because do you think later day seasons can affect?
I would go out on a limb and say Breaking Bad is the best show that is currently on right now.
Yeah,
definitely. Easy to say, but The Wire. Have you seen The Wire?
I'm in season two right now.
You're not even qualified until you've seen seasons three and seasons four of The
Conversation.
Wire.
Conversation.
Yeah. Look, Breaking Bad is amazing and, on a billion levels, and it's hard. It's also hard to compare them. You know, they're all awesome.
That entirely being said, different.
Now what do you think about Treme?
I haven't seen Treme because you know my new thing now is. The having experienced the television shows this way, and obviously from the outside looking in, a lot of people said, hey, that's how I watched Lost. And they weren't able to start saying that until the show ended. So they were like, I waited for the show to end, and this is how I consumed it. And I believe that there's a huge difference in the way that those people perceive the series than the way that the people who watched it, the way that it was broadcast. And if I had watched Battlestar Galactica the way that everybody watched it while it was on, I'd probably have a much different perception than I watched the entire series of Battlestar Galactica over the course of maybe 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And so the idea of kind of going on the web, comparing theories, it's like, oh, there's five more Cylons. 2 days later, I found out who they were. Yeah. So but in real life, you had to wait a year and a half. So with that year and a half come a certain level of expectations, speculation, you know, so
and you forget stuff too. You absolutely forget details that are so important. I mean, when I got into Lost, it was after season two, so I got to watch the first two seasons
right
all back to back, and it was so gratifying to know. And Buffy the same way. I watched all seven seasons in a like 6 week period, and it was just great to see everything and be able to not have to have my attention diverted week to week.
Serialized television needs to be watched that way, which is, you know, which is a horrible way. You know, obviously I wouldn't say to the networks, don't pick up serialized TV anymore, but to manage it yourself, to basically watch it at the pace that you want to watch it, to be able to go back and sort of flip around and have it in your head. It would be like reading a book one chapter at a time, once a week, in the midst of reading seven other books.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that'd be awful.
You know, it would be terrible. I mean, Dickens basically, you know, he wrote Great Expectations as a serialized novel. It was once a week. And then basically people hated the ending. So in the novelization of Great Expectations, he changed it. And that's the way that we read it now as a novel, as Great Expectations. But I think, you know, fundamentally, that's the way that it should be read. I can't imagine reading something a chapter at a time.
That's so interesting. I've never really thought about it like that. But that ability to just consume it all, you really get to look at the big picture instead of being in the moment and sort of waiting.
Well, yeah, because you're not having to devote.
But a part of me enjoys the waiting thing too.
But you're not having to devote any mental power to trying to catch up week to week, where you watch something and then instantly 60% of it's gone from your head.
Yeah, but there is also those moments you have though, like in Lost, where someone would come back or something would happen, like, you know, way after the fact, and then you go, oh, and you remember. It's like seeing remembering an old moment or an old friend. You're like, oh my god, I completely forgot that guy. That's right, and you know, all the rush of memories comes right back after a long period of time.
No,
and that's a fun moment, but I see what you mean by the.
There's also a unifying factor to watching it. So, like, you know, if Michael kills Anna Lucia and Libby, and you have that experience with the 10 million other people who are watching it on that night, you can basically go, oh my god, did you see that? Whereas when I'm watching The Wire and something incredible happened, I'm like, who do I get to talk to about this?
Yeah,
right,
and then you tell somebody, they're like, oh, yeah, I remember when that happened.
Or
I get
to go on a message board that's from like 3.5 years ago and like sort of vicariously pretend that it's happening now.
I'll tell you what I did enjoy, and I think maybe this was season three or season four, is when they were dropping in commercial spots from the Hanzo Foundation.
We did it a couple times. The first one, the first Hanzo ad was right before the season one finale.
Yeah. But just going online and just all that ARG stuff and uncovering shit and like I got into that stuff.
Yeah, that's the argument for watching it while it's on, which is, you know, you get to be a part of that huge water cooler of everybody else watching it. So I'd like to reverse my earlier position and now say both are awesome.
Breaking Bad, I watched all three seasons in a row. And that was grueling. That took a lot out of me. It's like you watch that show and you're just in this zone of people just doing horrible things. And then you have to go out into the real world. And it's hard to do. I found it hard. Like I was like, and I was also keeping it from my girlfriend because I was supposed to wait to watch them all. Mm-hmm. I wasn't working at the time. So I started watching it without her. I was like, I'll just watch an episode or two. And then I started watching the whole thing and not telling her. And she's like, "What'd you do today?" I just
jerked off all day.
Yeah, I jerked off all day.
I cheated on you.
I cheated on you.
There's
a dead hooker in the basement.
Whatever. But you didn't watch Breaking Bad, right?
No, absolutely not. Oh my God, I never do that to you.
Dead and alive.
Yeah. So that kind of like, it was like, I felt like I was like watching this thing about people lying to each other and their loved ones. And I was going, doing the same thing on a very much smaller
It is, you know, like Breaking Bad and Mad Men are like, I have a difficulty watching shows like that back to back. Episodes because I just need a break from the dirty feeling that I get after like the sad, you know, like heavy feeling that I get after I watch.
Think about Mad Men though, is that they treat it like a serial when it really kind of isn't in a weird way. There's no like there's nothing really episode to episode to really connect. They're like, but they do stuff that's like that with the next time.
There are definitely overarching stories that reconnect at certain points, but each one is
kind of a standalone.
You, when they get into the Dick Whitman stuff of it all, you know, Don's past, that's where you're kind of like, okay, I'm expected to know this. But also I think for those shows that do 13 episodes a year, it's a little bit easier to kind of, you know, to kind of track it. It's 10 less episodes to track than a network television show. And for Breaking Bad, I started watching it in the first season on AMC when it was on. And about 5 episodes in, I was completely and totally riveted and loving it. But then I just completely fell off the train because I got consumed by work. And I said, oh, I'll just watch this when the DVD came out. Mm-hmm. And then it was just one of those things where, I'll just wait until the end of season 2. So now it's like, of course, I decided to do, I went back and started all over again, watched it all the way through. And now I have to wait, you know, four or 5 months with everybody else. And I'll start getting my hits, you know, one drag at a time, which is going to be tough.
Like I wonder sucker. if there's going to be a massive paradigm shift if Google TV catches on, or if there's an iteration of Apple TV where essentially networks become apps that you can know.
The paradigm shift is this Netflix deal, this Fincher, Kevin Spacey deal, which is the game changer, which is, you know, essentially now. It's an app, it's Netflix, it's a delivery system, it's a network, it's distribution. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the idea of, if you want to watch David Fincher's new television show, you have to subscribe to Netflix. Mm-hmm. So in the same way where if we wanted to watch The Sopranos, we had to subscribe to HBO. And if we want to watch Breaking Bad or Mad Men or Walking Dead, we have to subscribe to basic cable that carries AMC, et cetera. So now if you want to watch David Fincher's new show, you have to subscribe to Netflix. Now it's essentially a network. If that show is good enough to basically say, that's worth $11.99 a month for me. In addition to all the other shit that I can stream off of Netflix.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if they can get 1 million people to subscribe to Netflix that weren't subscribers before, just because of the Fincher show, that's literally like, you know, $110 million.
And also it's so funny the sort of the delineation in people's mind between television and internet and film. The fact that internet stuff gets far more views than network television gets, I mean, in certain areas, and yet still does not get anywhere near the kind of respect of, but it's not television, and it's not a film. You're like, but 10 million people watch this thing. That's still more than, you know.
At their desks at work.
Right. You still have, like, older, like, you know, Sumner Redstone is still the CEO of Viacom.
So they use this word content to basically, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's all content. And it's like, it's a show. Like, this David Fincher thing is a show. Like, is it a television show? Who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, I can get Netflix on my TV, and within a year, and most people can. They just can't be bothered to hit the 4 buttons on the remote required to basically hook your Netflix account into your TV. But once I'm watching the Fincher show on the TV in my living room, then it becomes a TV show.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and that's why you know, with Google TV or any of the new platforms that come around that are just really potentially successfully merging those mediums together.
Yeah, well, I mean, also like there's certain Blu-ray players and PlayStation 3, you can have Hulu Plus, so you can subscribe to Hulu Plus. That also, I think, now they have already had original programming, I believe.
The fucking problem is just one thing to start aggregating all the different platforms. It's like, oh, you know, we get Zune and Netflix on the Xbox. We get Netflix and Apple on the Apple TV.
Yeah.
The PS3, you get Hulu Plus. It's just like, I've run out of HDMI ports.
Yeah,
my television for external
devices.
Yeah.
The thing about the Xbox though that isn't as good. I mean, I know Xbox has Zune, which is nice for like downloading movies, but you have to pay monthly or a yearly fee to have Xbox Live. While PS3 and the Wii is free. It's free. You can stream Netflix.
The television, like the whole cable box idea, even for me personally, just in my own life as it stands, I have a PS3 in my bedroom, and I stream everything in there, including with MLB's app, the MLB.TV app. I can stream Red Sox games. I can watch either the home or the away feed of the game, depending on who I want to listen to comment on it live, or I can watch it later and just jump to whatever inning I want. And it's that kind of stuff, the ability to just manipulate the content how I want and around me. Sorry,
those are good things, and there are bad things too, because we are definitely becoming a culture of spoiled consumers, because we expect that we can get whatever we want, whenever we want, however we want it. And so I feel like if you're making stuff, it just becomes a little bit harder, because everyone, like so many people can say, like, you didn't do this exactly how I wanted it, so fuck you. And you're like, oh, fuck, god damn it.
Well, entertainment seems to be disposable at this point, but that's probably what, the film people thought TV. It's like, oh, it's disposable entertainment. Yeah. It just runs and then you're done. But I think it will find it. There's going to be tons of
shit.
Or
what play actors thought of the radio.
Possibly.
But if you build it, they will come. I mean, the thing is, if there's something worth watching, it creates that have you seen effect. Mm-hmm. And it's suddenly like, I'm trying to explain to my wife the video, the Rebecca Black video Friday. I'm like, you have to fucking see this. And she's like, what is it? Why do I have? I say, I cannot adequately explain why you need to see it.
Yeah.
You just have to watch it, because everyone else in the continental United States has seen it. And if you do not see it, you are outside the bubble. If people will do that for that video, why wouldn't they do it for an awesome TV show? I mean, it just, none of us watched the Rebecca Black video at the same time, but we, over a course of 48 hours, we all watched it. And then that creates us that water cooler effect that I was discussing earlier, where we can now suddenly, Jimmy Fallon is talking about the Rebecca Black video and Colbert is talking about it. And then Colbert is now singing Friday on Jimmy Fallon. And
like, Taylor Hicks.
And the half-life of the Friday video is about 10 days. So now it's gotten to the point where, it's actually passe for me to be talking about Rebecca Black on this podcast.
I remember I saw that thing like come up, like people were posting it on their Tumblr, just saying, it's like, oh, check out the Rebecca, this is hilarious, it's dumb. And then like I was like, I don't need to watch it. And then it started even more, and then more and more, and then all the memes started to pop up.
Right.
And like, and then once like, and then parody videos, and I was like, fuck, at this point now I have to be able to know the reference point, I have to go back.
That's
now
the most fascinating thing about that Know Your Meme website,
yep,
is they track internet traffic by date.
Oh, that's pretty great.
It's a flow chart to understand where
who posted it and then what the spike was, and then like it shows you the life of it.
But I just worry that very few things that spike like that are actually good. That there's this sort of weird, ironic, I guess sadlarious is the word that I use, that something has to be that bad to get memed, I mean, like, are we actually appreciating good things, or is it just like, oh, this thing I saw is so shitty, everyone's got to see how shitty it is?
Well, yeah, I mean, a large part of it is just how long it is, and I think that, the idea of like, this is just going to take 3 minutes to watch, or the little girl who's bowing down before Vader is all right, that's 25 seconds. It's harder to get somebody to say, hey, commit yourself to 45 minutes and watch this thing, but you're not going to say, watch this 45 minute thing because it sucks. You're going to say, watch this 45 minute thing because it's rad.
Right.
You know? And the Vader thing is about as rad as it gets. I mean, there's no mocking to be made.
No,
you're just
basically,
I want to talk to that little girl. She's going to be on Good Morning America.
That guy, like the guy who's hosting.
I read about it.
Oh, it's so amazing.
Oh,
and then the guy, like, she wants to turn herself over to the dark side. And so the guy who's hosting the thing, who's in some sort of, Jedi garb, he's like, oh, well, we'll send you over here to the Sith Academy. Like, he just basically ushers her off stage, like, get out of here, kid. And I know he couldn't because it was Disneyland, but I so wish he would have been able to run with it and just see where that could have gone.
Then you must die, and then chase her around.
Right.
Is the Darth Vader, like, the voice
first
they
you
have
will,
is not pre-recorded?
First you will have to disavow yourself of your parents.
Yeah, bring her parents to the front.
Don't do it.
And then she just beheads them.
Yeah,
of course.
In front of everyone. That'd be super awesome.
Show your allegiance.
That's fascinating.
So how did your writing process evolve from the time you started Lost through afterwards? Like, how do you write? Do you sit down to write, or do you write when you are you more of a putting out fires kind of a writer? Or are you like, no, I'm going to write a little bit each day?
You know, Lost was obviously hugely collaborative, and, you know, that show was basically written in the writer's room. So there were eight of us at any given time, you know, pounding out story and script, and, you know, any given day, you know, the intensity level would basically, you know, vacillate between, if it were a script that Carlton and I were writing, it would be a lot more intensive for me in terms of writing versus, you know, other writers, you know, generating drafts of their scripts. Now that the show is over, it's just me. Mm-hmm. So I function best in collaboration. So I've sought out, you know, writing partners. This thing that I just did for Ridley Scott, this movie Prometheus, is the first thing that I've written by myself, you know, I think ever.
Really?
You know, at least as a professional writer, I was obviously writing really, really bad screenplays when I first came out to LA in my 20s that I would never let anybody see. And one of which I entered into a screenwriting competition and it did okay, but that was enough to give me the kick in the pants to say, I'm going to make a go of this. But then I instantly went into TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so on Trek One, I produced it. But was obviously very involved in the story process with JJ and Bob and Alex and all that stuff. So that was great. Trek 2, I'm actually writing and producing, but I'm writing it again, and it functions a lot more like a TV show where we're all sitting in a room together, throwing ideas around, seeing what sticks. Prometheus was the first thing where it was basically kind of come in, you know, read this draft. This guy, John Spates, had written an awesome draft that I was like, why aren't you guys making this movie? But the politics of the town, what have you, basically dictated, well, what would you do with it? And so I'm sitting in a room with Ridley Scott basically saying, well, you could do this maybe. And then I'm collaborating with him. And he's got this amazing producer, this guy, Michael Ellenberg. And so I always kind of seek out the collaboration. I do not like sitting by myself staring at the blank page. Like,
yeah.
I kind of really need to kind of know what I'm going to write before I get to that point. And the way that I find it is by stealing ideas from other people.
Or building and
who
collaborating.
Who are much more talented than I am.
No, I love writing through collaboration because it's one of the reasons why I like having these guys on the podcast so much, because it's just so much fun to bounce stuff around and build and
sure
create.
Is Chris.
what I'd never realized before I came here and did this podcast, just listening to it, was that it's entirely scripted. That I came in, you handed, I'm reading this right
your
now.
Cold,
what I'm
your
saying.
Cold reading is fantastic.
It is. Because you guys make it sound so organic.
They know the word there, that you know, organic. Yeah. You have the old script.
Well, the thing is,
my hands cramp up when I type how many times I have to say like.
This is now the fifth
are
take.
These the
of
Goldenrod pages?
This is the fifth take of this bit, and the way that we all overlap each other, that's the hard,
it that really
the
hard is.
Part. I'll just
so
need
hard.
An edit point so right. I can get a sound of this. Victoria Knight Pulliam.
That's a good callback.
Now, see, you added good that time.
No, I said good.
Don't go off the page, Jonah.
First, I did first in the.
Don't go off the page.
Then I say good.
This is why, you know. This is why.
Like, that's a callback.
All right, guys.
We rehearse these shows all week long, 8 hours a day.
We have to replace Jonah, Paul Giamatti, or Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That's a callback.
To another episode.
By definition, callbacks are always good.
Yeah.
Always sure. good.
Do I say it when you just reference callbacks?
No.
Okay.
Are we calling back callbacks now?
Very mad.
I just say thank you as a lifelong Star Trek fan for that Star Trek movie not sucking.
You're very welcome.
Yeah,
obviously many talented individuals, but
it was so great. I went and saw it with my buddy Will Wheaton, who of course is a very critical
Wesley Crusher.
And we came out of the movie and we both we took pictures of ourselves with huge smiles on our face. He loved it and I loved it, and I fucking love Carl Urban. Is it Urban?
Yes.
Urban.
He's so good.
He's sort of like the...
Do you know that he changed his name from Carl Rural?
Interesting.
It's weird.
To be more street.
He was not getting any work. Changed it.
You know, you're a little too country boy. All right, how about Urban?
Carl Black Culture.
I like it.
Wow.
Carl Metropolitan. that guy, first of all, that guy's like... is like, I'm going to sound a little gay. He's like dark-haired Brad Pitt.
Very handsome.
And a fucking, he's a really great actor.
And he's a Kiwi who does, you know, kind of an amazing American Southern accent. That's true. He's not American.
He's great. I thought he was great as Bones.
He's amazing.
Were you there when Tyler Perry was on set?
I was there, yes. When Mr. Perry was on set, yes.
Now I'm not sure.
Do you want to wear a wig?
I think I understand Madea now because of all the billboards around town. She pronounces words wrong.
Right.
She adds the letter R or T, whereas you and I might say good afternoon. She says good afternoon. So, right. I mean, you can see the endless comedy possibilities.
And when you say hallelujah, she says hallelujah.
Yeah. Right. Hallelujah. That's not the right word for that.
Yeah.
Oh, Madea. Yeah.
Speaking of things I'm nerding out over.
What?
That.
You think there are Tyler Perry nerds? Of course there are.
Yeah.
Tyler Perry, look.
They're called black people.
I'm not just saying this because Tyler Perry was in Star Trek. Tyler Perry is awesome. He's a billionaire. Whether you like what he does or not, you have to step back and have incredible admiration for what he's doing.
I absolutely
do. And the amounts that he outputs.
As someone who is fascinated by watching things get built and industries get built, and that guy fucking made an industry around himself.
Yeah, he is a genius.
But what was the deal for his show? What's the show? Like Meet the Browns? And like his whole thing was like, "Hey, I'll pay for the first season,
right?
If it gets this amount of these numbers, you pick it up for I think like 100 episodes or 200 episodes." And it got the numbers, and then he's like, "Great deal!"
Now he owns TBS.
Yeah, pretty much most of it, right?
No, he is. That guy's brilliant. That guy's a genius.
You know, this town basically functions on a certain sort of set of business propositions where it's like, well, this is the way it's done. And if you don't like it, then you're not going to work in this town. And
yeah.
this is what Carlton and I were up against with Lost, where it was like, we want to end the show. And they were like, that's not the way it works. You can't end a show because people are still watching the show and it's a broadcast television show. This is not The Office. You are not Ricky Gervais. You know, Lost has 15 million people watching it and we're not going to end it. And then you basically just have to come to you have to argue to think about things differently and to explain that the overall vitality of the show is contingent upon it ending and that maybe the aftermarket value of the show will increase as a result of ending it, et cetera. But where I give Tyler Perry props is he basically completely and totally rejects the norm and says, I'm going to come at it. Why can't you do it this way? Why can't you do it that way? Why can't you do it this way? And he's, you know, just as a businessman, forget about the content that he's providing, is just he's a genius.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and a lot of it has to do with, his mindset is very new media based in the sense that, you know, like we're talking about the internet platform, like the web platforms, is that really what it boils down to is, can you reach an audience? It's the same as performing stand up and live shows. Will X number of people come out? Will X number of people watch this thing? And in the past, because of the limitations of technology, consumer based technology, everything is, well, we rely on networks and studios for the delivery systems. But now, if it's really just a matter of, well, I can just go pay, make a thing, and then I know these people will watch it, and then that's it. You've cut out that middle process.
Describing Kevin Smith's Red State situation where he's just
I wonder how that's going.
I think they think he's going to start it in smaller. They're going to bring it to smaller theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And very soon it will be turning a profit. Like, 'cause it didn't cost much to make, and the tour, they're going to be able to sell cheaper tickets. And
yeah,
stuff.
They did an article on him, the LA Weekly, and he says he's getting paid to advertise the movie, essentially, because he's doing the tour where he's just going to go speak about the movie.
Yeah.
And these venues are giving him money from the door to speak about the movie. So he's telling all these people about the movie, and he's getting money.
Yeah.
Like, he's doing it in kind of a really interesting way.
That's cool. It'd be interesting to see if it works. I mean, he has a very specific audience, but I would imagine not everyone will be able to pull off that system.
Well, the crazy thing is he's screening these movies. He's screening the movie at these events.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a large amount of people that are going to see it.
Yeah.
So will they see it again? Will the money be there?
Tune in next week.
I mean, my suspicion is if you subscribe to any conspiratorial thinking, that the story is going to be that it didn't work because, you know, that's what the media has to say.
Right.
But he will probably say, oh, it worked fabulously.
Right.
And I'm going to go ahead and side with him.
Okay.
I believe.
But he's never one for, you know, lying. Like I'm sure he'll be pretty honest about how much it helped.
My father gave me a piece of advice that I'll never forget. And he said, always trust a man in a duster. And I'm gonna side with Kevin Smith on this one. Yeah. It's never that advice I've always followed.
It's never led you astray.
It's very rare where it comes into play, but when it does, I trust that man.
I'm curious. Maybe we talked about this at the Comics on Comics panel. How do you pitch Lost? Like my perception of networks is that everything has to be very like, oh, A plus B equals C. So how do you pitch a show that has so much, had such a mysterious element to it? And I mean, did you sort of pull the old switcheroo on him somehow, or how did you get him to?
The show was kind of pitched to us, and that's what was enormously liberating about it, which is that this guy Lloyd Braun, who was the president of ABC, really wanted to do what he referred to as Survivor, the drama series. Mm-hmm. Survivor at that time in 2003, 2004 was enormously popular, and the idea of setting a drama series on an island with beautiful people and blue water and sandy beaches was just, let's do that. Let's just do Castaway. You know, let's do a show about a plane that crashes on an island. And they hired Aaron Spelling, of all people, to develop that show. And it did not turn out the way that they wanted it to.
So they wanted to put Tori in it.
Yeah, exactly. They came to JJ in late January, which is, you know, normally pilot season happens over the preceding summer and they start to pick up the shows, you know, November, December. So at the last week of January, they came to JJ and said, will you, you know, we don't want to let this go. Will you do this show? He had already written this other pilot called The Catch that was about bounty hunters, and he was about to go and direct that, and he was still running. He was running the third season of Alias. So he was like, I don't have time to do this. If you bring in another writer and they have a take on it, maybe I'll produce it. And my friend Heather, then Leighton, now Caden, called me and basically said, do you want to meet J.J. Abrams? And I'd been stalking her for 2 years to just get in a room with the guy because I worshipped Felicity and Alias. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's not about Alias. It's about this other thing that's never going to happen in a billion years, but at least it'll give you something to talk about and you can make an impression. And that was on a Friday night. And Monday afternoon, I came in and I met with J.J. And that Saturday, we delivered an outline 5 days later for what we would do with this idea. And it had all those crazy mythological elements. It had the flashbacks, it had the monster, it had, you know, all the wackadoo stuff. And we were basically like, this is what we would do with this show. What do you think? And Lloyd was so, you know, either desperate and or trusting. He just said, go. Now he got fired halfway into production. And that was the point where we were like, this show's never going to get picked up. We have no idea if the new, you know, person in the captain's chair is going to embrace it. It was this guy, Steve McPherson, who was running the studio at the time that the show got greenlit and now running the network at the time that it was time to decide whether it was going to make it to air. And he said, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And so the answer is we never really pitched it. We just tried to take an untenable premise, which is people crash land on an island. What's episode 12 going to be? Like, isn't the show just going to be about them trying to get off? There's a reason in Castaway that, you know, they cut. Like, after he makes he makes fire, he's like, I made fire 4 years later. Now it's time to get the fuck off the island.
Yeah.
You know, so our entire show took place in between the fire and Tom Hanks building a raft.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, what's going to make that interesting to watch? And we didn't know, you know, we didn't know. We were just like, this is how, you know, we're going to focus on the characters and we're going to make the island very mysterious. And, you know, we're going to kind of throw up a Hail Mary and see what happens.
And in a way, I kind of feel bad about even asking you questions about it because I know that it's just so consumed so much of your life. And to the point where the tweet you sent out about, like, condensing Lost into one tweet was so great. Genius.
Oh, thanks. I mean, you know, the beauty of that is someone who was following me was basically like, hey, you should start this Twitter trend, Lost in one tweet. Here's mine. And then I basically said, oh, fun. Like, here's mine. And so I can't even take credit for having come up with that idea. But it felt like, here's
just
the thing.
Like,
it's like,
Lost.
Yeah. Hmm. I've kind of struggled with this, you know, on Twitter, which is, you know, how often should I tweet about Lost? Like, mm-hmm. Because I think about it all the time, obviously. It was this big defining event in my life. And obviously, my emotional sort of response to other people's response to the finale is on my mind a lot. And certainly my anytime anything happens, people are tweeting about it on my feed. So I go like, if I were a fanboy and I were following Damon Lindelof, would I want him to talk about Lost all the time? Well, fuck. That's why they're following me. They're not following me because I'm a bald Jew. Like, you know,
I'm sure there are some.
I right. am.
A few. And I will tweet for you guys about premature hair loss and Judaism. But no, so it's kind of like, you know, if I'm following Ashton Kutcher, I'm following him because I want him to fucking tweet photographs of Demi Moore in various states of undress. So give me what I fucking want. You know, I don't want to hear you talking about like all the great charitable organizations. It's awesome, Ashton, that you care about these things, but that's not why I'm following you. So that's kind of my, you know, my take on it. And I understand that, you know, there's this other thing about me, which is I'm a geek and I'm interested in geek culture, nerd culture, whatever you want to call it. So I tweet about that stuff as well. But I do feel a certain obligation. If I'm going to be egotistical enough to think that people want to hear what I have to say on Twitter, I'm going to try to give them what I perceive they want.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do you remember what the Lost in One tweet was? Do you remember what it was?
I think it was some variation on that. Damaged.
Fix it broken.
Yeah. Damaged people crash land on damaged island.
Yeah.
Fix selves, then island. All walk into light. Boo! Exclamation point. Sorry. Yay! Exclamation point. And then parenthetical or boo!
Or boo.
Exclamation point.
Yeah. When I saw it too, I was like, yeah, that's it.
There you go.
That's fine.
No reason to watch it now.
No, there is. But still.
And then there are people on my feed who are like, spoiler alert. And I'm like, God, if you're following me and you don't want me to talk about the Lost finale, why are you following me? Yeah. They're still waiting for the bald Jew commentary.
You know, where the finale was, that church, that's where I had the funerals for my grandparents.
Yeah, Jonas from Hawaii.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, we talked about that last time. Yeah, I was born and raised. Yeah, I went to St. Louis, which was across the street from there. But that was like Sacred Hearts or St. Patrick's. They're right next to each other.
Uh-huh.
But that's... yeah, that's like where I've been there.
Jonah's a Hawaiian.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, the Camp
Erdman. Not that you're a Hawaiian, but that you know.
Yeah, Camp Erdman. I stayed there a weekend once that you guys blew up for New Otherton.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's like a YMCA camp.
It made it kind of hard to watch it sometimes because like I'd be like, that's not Seoul, Korea. That's near the convention center. That's down the street from Ala Moana.
You live there. But I wonder, you know, like
you're giving away all the magic now.
All the magic. Okay. No, just people who watched it like hated it watching it with me because I would be like, that's not high bed.
But it's
that's not Beverly Hills.
But it's all real. You understand. It all really happened.
It all really happened. I was there. It was a documentary on life in Hawaii.
Yes.
But I love the point that you made when we did the panel about how, like, you can control the story in as much as you can control the actors and what they decide they want to do. Like, you know, you said, oh, yeah, we had this really long arc planned for Mr. Echo. And then he decided he didn't want to be in Hawaii anymore and fucking left.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the nature of the beast. And I think that. If you're J.K. Rowling and you're writing novels, you can have the characters do whatever they want. And when the actors sign up for the movie adaptation of that, it's kind of like, hey, listen, you know, Dumbledore, you should know this going in. You're gay. Like, is that gonna be a problem for you? And you can even switch.
Not for this old wizard.
You can even switch Dumbledore's midstream and nobody cries foul. But if we had basically said, like, you know what, Otto Wally doesn't want to do the show anymore. We're just going to bring in another fine actor to portray the role of Mr.
Like
Echo.
A soap opera.
We're gonna Darren him.
Now playing the part.
No, not an option. So what you do is you say, we're going to kill this guy off. And obviously that's not according to the plan. And it felt that way when we wrote it. And it felt that way when people watched it. And
well, you can't you can't count on people living forever, man.
That's true.
Whenever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just like, you know, it was unfortunate and lame. And the larger factor, you know, in terms of the way that the entire second season and the first half of the third season played out was we just couldn't move forwards because of we didn't have an end date yet. So the show was so desperate to have the Oceanic Six leave the island. And that's something that we knew we wanted to do. It was like, that's the next phase of storytelling is some people get off. And then that sounds dirty. Some people get off the island, you know, and then what happens next, but nobody could leave the island until we had an end date. So that entire period of storytelling just, you know, was enormously dictated by that limitation.
Well, but I think what's great is that, I mean, you've moved on to awesome stuff. I mean, the idea.
I'm so glad it's over, and I mean that, you know, with a tremendous amount of respect for the show and having loved doing it. But it was, you know, I can't imagine, you know, what it would be like to have left the show and have it still be going on, you know, without me or, you know, or anything else. It was enormously liberating to be like, this was 6 years of my life, and now, you know, now I'm doing other stuff.
Did you live on Hawaii the whole time?
No, very rarely. Carlton went to Hawaii a lot more often than I did. The first season I went back and forth a lot, like, you know, basically was commuting to Hawaii. But then much more sporadically as time went on. By the time we did the last season, I probably went only like four times, maybe five times over the course of the entire season. Because we wrote the show, we edited the show, we cast the show all out of L.A.
How do you keep stuff from getting out? Like, how do you... I asked Stephen Moffat the same question about, like, you have answers in your head about storylines that, you know, millions of people would claw their eyes out to get at. You have this stuff that's in your head. How do you keep that in? How do you keep that shit from getting out?
We couldn't. I mean, the reality was that, you know, there were sort of abundant spoilers. Once you put an idea onto paper, there, you know, it exists, and a lot of people can see that paper, and there were probably more people interested in what was in the hatch than that are interested in what's in the documents for WikiLeaks. So, mm-hmm. you know, you know, if there's a strong desire for somebody to find out a secret, it's very, very difficult to hide it. And we had 400 people working on the show, and we decided to trust those people, you know, and that it doesn't mean that those people are the ones that are leaking it. But once you write it down on a piece of paper and you put it in script form and you say, this is what we're shooting, or this is the set that we need to start building, you know, and we're on the island of Hawaii, so you were there. You know what it's like. I mean, it's not like we had, you know, jackbooted guards basically surrounding our stages.
You got dudes. Yeah. Just dudes.
Yeah, just dudes. And you just walk up to them, and you're like, what's going on here? They're like, we're shooting Lost, bro. You're not supposed to be here. And you're like, okay, you go. You get a telephoto lens, and then blammo.
Are you having the same... Is it the same thing with Star Trek series as well?
It's, you know, it's tough. Obviously, once you're in production, JJ is really good at secrecy and really good at playing the game, because ultimately people want to know, but they kind of don't want to have stuff spoiled for them. Mm-hmm. So it's more about like sort of engaging in the kind of, you know, Tom's not ever really going to catch Jerry, you know, because God forbid if he did, what would happen?
Well, you know? they would do that shitty iteration of the show where they became best friends.
Right.
Jerry wore a bow tie.
Actually, that'd be really funny if someone did that animation where like Tom finally catches Jerry.
Those guys must have like the old animators who were really like hilarious, sick fucks. That image exists somewhere. That footage exists somewhere.
The downside of it is that, you know, we're working on Trek 2 now, and there's such an expectation that it's top secret, just because everything we do is top secret. And with that expectation comes this idea that they're going to do just something totally mind-blowing in Trek 2 that's just going to, you know, frigging fry our brains because they're keeping it a secret, as opposed to the fact that we're just keeping it a secret because we don't want the audience to know too much about the movie going in. So, sure. You know, the fact that people went to go see Trek and they're like, they didn't know that we were going to blow up Vulcan, you know. They might have known that time travel was involved. They knew that Nimoy was going to be in the movie, but they kind of didn't understand how it all worked. So when you get to that point in the movie, you know, it's cool because you get to emotionally experience it without being primed for it. Mm-hmm. It requires a tremendous amount of, there's only a few select people that you can include in your circle of trust if you're going to do something like that.
It's got to be fun to sit down.
What's going to happen when Spock goes through Ponfar, you guys? Where is he going to go to mate?
I don't know, but you've got to stop slamming your hands on the table.
I'm sorry, I can't hear it. I have headphones.
Well,
the studio's weird.
Calm down. I know you're excited. Matthew is an enormous... As much of a Star Trek fan as I am, Matthew is insane Star Trek.
I just like, where's he going to go to mate? It's like, I can just see like the kind of commercial that caters directly to Vulcan. Yeah. You're in Ponfar. Where are you going to go to mate?
Those hormones are raging. You might feel a little angry.
Right, exactly.
Rigel, probably.
Strangling your friends, sweating a lot, meditation just not working.
In between,
you're in Ponfar.
In between those weird temple pulses.
Yeah.
Can't share what's going on with your captain and your best friend.
Ponfar. Ponfar, the new fragrance, right?
Oh, there is a Ponfar fragrance, I believe.
No, really?
Isn't there?
I know there's a Tiberius.
There's a Tiberius. There's also
I think,
Sulu.
Yeah, it's Chloe and Lamar's new fragrance is Ponfar.
It must be so incredible, though, to sit down at Final Draft or whatever script program you use and then see, like, interior, Enterprise, bridge. And you're like, this is not fan fiction. This is the actual Enterprise.
That is, you know, that is the coolest thing ever is playing in those universes and just, you know, writing like Kirk and then dialogue. And you're like, oh, my God.
You can make him talk.
And, you know, and for it was particularly awesome for writing the, as he was slugged in the script, original Spock, you know, because you're like, Nimoy is actually going to be saying these words. Jeez. You know, that's where you're. I just did this, you know, this story for Action Comics 900, which is, I think, coming out next week. And so, you know, DC called me up and said, do you want to do like a Superman story, just like a 10-pager, just a short little thing? And it's just, it's the coolest thing ever to just write a script and be like, ooh, I'm, you know, I'm playing in that world with those guys. You know, I'm getting to make them say stuff. It's pretty incredible.
You are going to be A-OK, Damon Lindelof. Yeah, it is fan fiction because you're a fan, but it's still official.
Right. It's like, fan fiction that someone sends you a check for.
I mean, we think of fan fiction as being sort of unofficial. Like, oh, these are things that we would like to see, but they're not officially sanctioned by such and such. And you are officially sanctioned by such and such. I mean, it's kind of a big, awesome deal.
The fact that anyone would officially sanction me to do anything is very frightening.
And yet it's been going on for years. And, you know, last year at the G4 party at Comic-Con, J.J. Abrams was there, and I fucking didn't get to say hi to him. I don't know what I would have expected was going to happen out of this exchange other than, hey, is this really nice to meet you? And then he would be like, okay, and then I would walk away. But, God, you know, I fucking love that guy, too.
Is that are you going to go with it's really nice to meet you?
I don't know. What should I?
I don't know. I just, you know, it probably, you should.
He loves time travel. Should I say, it's really nice to have met you?
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Right?
Or like, or walk up to him and say, in 5 minutes, someone who looks exactly like me, but dressed slightly differently is going to come up to you and ask you a question. You know, you have to run as fast as you possibly can. You're in a conversation with the guy.
I feel bad in the sense for, you know, for guys like you and JJ who write, you know, these sort of intricate sci-fi, because I imagine that fans constantly try to come up and say something that they think you will find super clever. And so there's probably always just like, okay.
First off, don't feel too bad for us. We're living the dream. And secondly, it's a very odd experience for me because, you know, I've been going to Comic-Con for many, 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 many years. And so suddenly I'm up there now on the dais, like, and people are there to talk about my show. But then once that experience ends, I'm just like, oh, I'm just going to walk around the floor and get some cool t-shirts. Mm-hmm. And if someone comes up to me and says, hey, I dig your show, my level, I want to be like, oh, what's your name? Like, let's have a chat now, because I was that guy. And like, if I were on the Comic-Con floor and I would see a comic book writer or artist that I totally dug, or like Bruce Campbell walk by, I'd be like, Bruce Campbell, I just have to say you're awesome. And he'd be like, thank you, you're awesome. Yeah. And that would like make my fucking year.
Yeah.
So the idea that anyone views me in that light of, oh wow, you were involved in something that I really dug, or you made something that I really dug, it's like, it's a slightly out of body experience for me.
Yeah, my level is lower than where yours is, but I still am constantly like, if people come up, I will always talk to people, because I feel like, no, I know what you're experiencing. I freak out about stuff and I want to say hi.
I saw Dan Aykroyd the other day at having coffee or lunch or something, and I just was so nervous. I just walked by.
You didn't say anything.
And then I stood and I stood.
That's a nice sighting, Aykroyd.
Yeah. Did you say, keep your eyes on the skies?
I wish he did.
I mean, Carlton and I went up to Skywalker, and we did this like Q&A with the people who work at ILM and Lucasfilm, and it was awesome. And then they're like, oh, hey, George is actually on the property. Do you want to go over and like say hi? And we're like, sure. Yeah, why not? And the thing is, you know, we sat down and we chatted with him, and it was the most surreal experience, because here's the guy who's basically like, in the time travel story of my life, if you went back in time and killed George Lucas, yeah, I would not... Mm-hmm. I would not be who I am by any stretch of the imagination. So, but he's just kind of talking to us like we're peers. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you know, you did your thing and I did my thing. And, you know, and I'm like, let me just sit here and fucking ask you questions about Kashyyyk. You know, like, I do not want to pretend to be a grown up right now. Like, I don't want to be your peer. I want to be your acolyte. I was that little girl in the AOL video. Like, yes. You know, it's fucking George, you know?
I always have a fancy of meeting George Lucas and then doing nothing but talk about American Graffiti. That would just be what
I want.
And
he would fucking love that.
He probably would love that.
He's a total gearhead. I mean, that's his thing.
Yeah, that's nice. So if you do see Damon Lindelof in public, give him a hug. Say hi. But not a creepy, too long hug.
Right.
Where you sweat on him. Just a nice. But I was like, when we had Nathan Fillion on the podcast, he said, you know, like he's totally cool if people just come up, nod and say, Cap'n.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, just the acknowledgement, you know.
And like he's that. Like, as you were.
Yes.
Oh, actually, that's funny. Bruce Campbell just did an AMA on Reddit. And then like someone said, when are you going to do something with Nathan Fillion? He says, as soon as I find out who he is.
Oh, that's awesome.
Genius. And the great thing about Nathan is he probably got a kick out of that.
Yeah.
He's totally rad. I mean, yeah, it's the great thing about Twitter is it's essentially your sort of own personal therapist in terms of like, this is on my brain and I'm going to get this out. So mm-hmm. if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I'm emotionally consumed by this idea of the finale. And so I talk about it a lot and I talk about people not liking it a lot and wrestling with that. So people will just walk up to me and basically be like, hey man, I really like the finale. And like, I'm like, thank you. Like, it's so nice. I've yet to have any experience in a person-to-person experience where someone comes up to me and says, I hated the finale, or you took 6 years of my life away. You see those, you see
it online.
Yeah, you see it online, or you see people.
Those are the same people that
blogging about
to you, though,
it
and say they love.
Yeah, but I have yet to have the sort of faith, and I constantly wonder/ask my therapist, what will I do when that happens? Because it's just a matter of time before I get engaged on that level on a person to person.
It might happen, and at that point you might just be like, well, sorry.
Right.
Sorry, I didn't like it. I don't know what to tell you.
But what will really happen is I'll go, why? Why? Can I change it?
You can't fix it.
Yeah.
You can't.
What can I do?
You can't fix them.
Yeah.
Because you forget that to walk up to someone and say, you're dumb. Like, that is that's not normal, I don't think. Right. Like, to go up to someone unsolicited to sling some shit at them is not, I feel like that's not a normal.
Happened to me in high school.
Well, it happened to me. Like, I've done so many crappy shows in my life. Like, after I started doing fucking Shipmates, some dude came up to me at a bar. He was like, hey, I saw your latest show. Not your best work. Not your best work.
Jeez.
I'm like, why would you say that?
And I have apologized for that, and you are going to keep bringing it up over and over again. I just wanted you to know.
Will you write Shipmates the movie? That's my big question. That's why we brought you here.
Those guys actually, and I say guys because it's guys, always would show up at Comic-Con. They'd be usually the second person standing in line at the mic, and you could tell that they had kind of already written what they wanted to say so that they could have their big kind of moment. But the joke would be that they would be always be sitting in the first three rows of Hall H, mm-hmm. which meant that they probably slept out, to basically tell you how much they hate the show. And so you have to take that in the context in which it's offered. Yeah. It's like, all right, well, you obviously hate it so much that you've dedicated the last 15 hours of your life.
Well, that's love or hate it. I love your dedication.
That's exactly what you were saying earlier about fandom is that. You have to love something so much to hate it so much. Like you can't, because if you're sort of ambivalent about something, it's like, it didn't really affect you either way. Like those are the people that don't really care about what you do.
Yeah. I'm thinking that's good.
You're gonna go with that.
Write that down.
You're gonna go with that. Well, we're at the end of our show. As people are peeking in.
Staring.
Hi, people outside. Go ahead, press your faces up there and officer. Damon, it was such a pleasure to have you on, and I hope you'll come back on again, another time, and after you finish writing Trek 2, and if you want to talk about anything else, you're always
please
welcome.
Come back
on
and talk
anytime.
About
this is a lovely experience.
Thanks.
It's excellent to have you on. Any parting thoughts? Any place you're at? Damon Lindelof, of course, on Twitter.
Yes. I'm really struggling to come up with some sort of Keisha Knight Pulliam, because you always want.
Right.
It was hackily handled, but you always want to end with a callback.
Yeah, I know. I was waiting for you, and I saw you tinkering
you
away.
Your Twitter handle's Damon Knight Pulliam.
We could all just say
that's good.
We could all just say callback on the count of three.
Yes.
One, two, three.
Callback. We should have really discussed how we were going to say callback because that was kind of a mess.
Nope.
Just like the THX sound.
Yeah.
you can do the THX sound. Who's you do? Have you done it with another person before?
We've done it with you.
We have done the THX sound.
Someone goes
can
low.
I do it too?
Yeah, sure. Here's what we do. We start off on the same note, mm-hmm. then I'll move up, and then you move low until we meet on the same note again, but on different octaves.
We'll stay in the middle.
I'm gonna pretend like I know what you just said.
So we'll start off on the same.
I'll go.
and then I'll go up, and then you start to go down until we meet again on the same note.
So you're going down. I'm going
so,
up.
So this is Lindelof's THX.
Yeah.
Did it work?
Oh, it's fun. It totally worked.
Wow.
It fucking right when you hear
we're
it.
We're certified
like,
now, guys.
Is that was me. Doing
is that
THX.
How they did the real one?
Probably. Just a couple dudes.
THX. Let's do the Pixar logo now.
Okay.
Who's got a lamp? Nice. Okay. that was good.
Any more logos? Come on. Come on. Let's do the DreamWorks.
Here's one. Enjoy your burrito. Oh, yeah. Slide that shit in.
Sit, boo boo. Sit. Good dog.
Wrong.
Bad robot. I might drop that in at the end.
Okay.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was kindly brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that is clean and simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to Hover.com, Hover.com/Nerdist.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
It's win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.